So the topic of this week is what really happened at Nicaea. And I was just, you know, I was wondering if people would file in. I was thinking, man, of all the weeks you don't want to miss this one. Okay, good, good, good. Because this is like, I was telling Hugh, this is like the, if there's ever a card trick in church history, it's right here. This is the grand curtain behind the grand Wizard of Oz of church history. This right here is where a lot of errors come from, is a comical view of what really happened at Nicaea. The words Nicaea and Constantine have become buzzwords in the modern seminary for history's most infamous backroom deal. Catholic historians see it against the backdrop of a church at the outset of the 4th century which was mired in devilish division and without clear leadership. And so they see what Constantine did and said, well, somebody had to do something, that kind of thing. Modern and postmodern cynics see nothing but smoke and mirrors. And the Christianity that emerged on the 19th century frontier in America came to absorb this smoke. If you want a mature way to summarize the 4th century, here's the way I would put it. The best way to summarize what happened in the 4th century is this, and you'll see this in your notes under the big idea, that in the 4th century, the essence of Christianity was defended and retained, while the expression of Christianity was distorted beyond recognition for many down to the present day. But let me just make a distinction between those two concepts. The essence of something versus the expression of something. In other words, the thing as it actually is versus the way that it might manifest itself, the way that it might play out, the way that some people will practice it. That's different than the thing itself. And so the card trick that happens in the 4th century is that, oh, it's just a madhouse the first 3 centuries. We don't know what happened. And we don't even know what scriptures we have, if they're the same thing. And so a lot of movements showed up in the 19th century that talked about a restoration of the church. Implication, we have no earthly idea what happened before Constantine. Because everything that happened came out of that smoke-filled room. But a more mature expression, as you chew the meat and spit out the bones of this period, is that the essence of Christianity was defended and retained in the 4th century, while the expression of Christianity was distorted. In introducing Constantine, you also have to introduce his friend and first great church historian, Eusebius Pamphilus. His dates are 263 to 339. Eusebius, also known as Eusebius of Caesarea, because he was named bishop there in 314. And this gave him proximate access to all available documents from the Holy Land, as well as an ear toward the kind of Christianity being practiced out east. That's important because it shows us that some of the early writings in church history are written by people that had intimate knowledge of that region and that kind of Christianity that was practiced out east. You know, the kind of Christianity that was just lost to us completely. We have no idea what happened. And especially among those whose writings still survive to this day. Constantine was born in 272 in Naissus, what's modern-day Serbia, but at the time it was Illyricum. And so this area right here, where he was probably born. He was the son of the partial emperor, sort of a military emperor, Constantinus Chlorus. And his reign, now you've got to understand at this time the empire was divided into four. Diocletian was ruling out east. But in the west, sort of this military province, they were all military provinces, but at that time it was divided into four. And so Constantine's father ruled out there and had his troops out there. And Constantine, as a young man, was sent to the eastern courts of Diocletian to be educated, and he became the favorite to take over the sole reign of the reunited empire. A lot of people liked him out there, including Diocletian. He proved himself in war and stuff like that, but the reality was he was basically a hostage in the courts of Diocletian so that his father wouldn't step out of line out west and lead a rebellion against some of the eastern emperors. Now, Constantine followed his father in breaking ranks with the traditional pagan deities to worship the sun deity of the Mithras cult. And the Mithras cult, we sort of covered it in a previous week, it combined the unity of everything in that you see in Neoplatonism. So in other words, it was kind of monotheistic. So forget about the map for a second. You had this idea of the one, but around that, the way you would worship this one was, in nature, the highest thing was the sun. And so that Latin phrase, sol invictus, the inconquerable sun, and that became the most popular religion among the military in particular, among Romans. But it combined this idea of Neoplatonism of the One with a cyclical account of history from Zoroastrianism. And so that became the popular cult religion, especially among the military elite. And of course, the military loved Constantine's father more than anybody else. Eventually, in 306, Constantine ran away from the court to join his father in his final crusade toward Britain, and just in time to be named the successor of the western quarter of the empire. So the soldiers and subjects basically made him emperor of the western region. And in particular, the Christians were fiercely loyal to him because they remembered well his father's good treatment of them during the last wave of persecution under Diocletian. So if you remember last, or 2 weeks ago, the last wave of persecution against Christians came from Diocletian. So right before Constantine is the worst and latest of all of the purges against Christians, or at least since Nero and Domitian in the first century. So you had a bunch of soldiers, the majority of whom were Christians or leaning toward Christianity, and the fact that this general, who was not a Christian, he was a sun worshiper, but he extended toleration long before Constantine took over the whole empire. The West had toleration while the East was undergoing the worst persecution that there was so far. So, in 312, Constantine marched his outnumbered forces toward Rome to face the superior forces under Maxentius. And so they are coming from where they were had this military campaign over the Alps down toward Rome. And Maxentius' forces were far superior in number. And the shields, interestingly, of his soldiers bore the inscription with the Greek letters Chi and Rho. And actually, that symbol was, and I don't remember how it was, whether it was like that, but they were right on top of it. There's a name for that, and I thought about it a million times this week, and I forget it now. Labrium or Labarium or something like that, and I just stink and forgot it. But anyway, it's made up of those. Now, you'll notice that those in the Greek are the first two letters of Christ's name, Chi and Rho. Okay, and so that became sort of an abbreviation for Christ. And the other reason that's interesting is because of that famous dream, supposedly, that Constantine had. Now, the earliest account we have of it is a guy named Lactantius, who was made the tutor of Constantine's son. But he was there, unlike Eusebius, he was actually there with his forces at that time. And to his recollection, this was a dream that Constantine had the night before, or one of the nights before. But if you ask Eusebius years later, Eusebius heard from Constantine himself that it was actually during the day. And as he was coming up to this bridge, up in the sun was the inscription, under this sign, conquer. And it was the sign of the cross. Okay, and so Constantine, now of course people debate all the time that that was the beginning of the justification for a just war doctrine in Christianity, when really, if you're really a Christian ruler, you would put away the sword and stuff like that. Well, that's another subject for another day, but this became a famous vision that Constantine claimed that he had and supposedly converted, sort of, at about that time. But this occurred a few miles north of Rome in October of 312. Now, for the historian, it doesn't seem to me important to settle the truthfulness of the accounts, nor to reconcile the ideas of just war and what a real conversion of a Christian prince would look like. The significance of Constantine to church history is not the genuineness of his own faith. I don't care whether or not he was a real Christian, and I don't think you should either. The real question is, what is the product that resulted from that? In Constantine's pagan mind, he saw no contradiction between the general notion of the sun god and the person of Christ. Now, how elaborate the thinking of such a man with such a place in war and politics, how he conceived of such things, remains a mystery. But for the Roman who worshipped the sun above everything else, that was seen as the closest thing you could find to monotheism, since the sun was the highest form in nature. So that's just one reason why anywhere you looked in the empire, coins, royal edicts, the statues that you'd eventually see adorning pagan temples and even civic centers in Constantinople and elsewhere, there is this close connection between the worship of the sun and, of course, Christmas Day. As YouTube videos never tire of reminding us, there was, you know, this thing Isis already said, or the mother goddess in the East already said, and stuff like that, and it's just a bunch of nonsense the Christians have already known. And when it was this struggle for Christians to root that out in the 4th century, when it was clear and it was everywhere, there's nothing secret about it, that Sol Invictus cult. But Eusebius wasn't exaggerating in the least when he said that this period was most momentous for the world's history. Constantine's mind was prepared. He was alert and ready to act. So in spite of a 2-to-1 manpower disadvantage to Maxentius and a carefully planned trap, everything backfired on Maxentius, and Constantine was now sole emperor of the West, and the emperors were reduced into 3. In fact, at the river Tiber, Maxentius even drowned. No, he didn't drown, but he was found in there. I think they beheaded him. I don't remember what they did to him. But at the time, they made a big deal. Oh, this is just like Pharaoh being drowned in the river and his forces. And so everything was given biblical overtones. Now, the arch that the Senate erected in honor of Constantine after that attributes the victory to Sol Invictus, again, that inconquerable sun deity, and not specifically to the Christian God. The coins that he would mint honored Christ on one side and the heathen sun god on the other. Yet in all of the surviving written communications that we have of Constantine, he considered himself a Christian ruler, and he considered himself someone who was charged to keep the church together. All of his public documents show the adjective Catholic immediately joined to the hip of the faith. And his usage of that word is just the correct usage, universal. Now, how he defined that universality and how he tried to accomplish it is another matter. Now, his first order of business was to officially make his doctrine of toleration the rule throughout the whole empire. Well, there's one problem with that. He may have defeated Maxentius, but the empire is still divided. And so out east, another ruler, Licinius, is putting two and two together and realizing now Licinius has no care whatsoever for the Christian faith. He's a complete pagan. But he sees that this is politically expedient. And so the two come together in the same year, 312, maybe the beginning of 313, historians debate, and they form a pact that became the Edict of Milan. And that essentially extended this idea of toleration and the doctrine, I don't know why I can't think of the word, the practice of toleration official policy, there you go, the policy of toleration everywhere throughout the empire. Now, Licinius was going to go back on that, but at any rate, at the time, the whole idea was to make what we would today call freedom of religion for everybody. It wasn't so much in favor of Christianity, but at the time, it was the first step toward that. It was toleration for every religion, which it wasn't practiced, universally or consistently, but that was the idea of it. Just to give you a couple ideas of how Constantine affected law at the beginning, just to give you a fair treatment of this mixed bag. Crucifixion, as such, was outlawed in 315. Facial branding was outlawed the year after, 316. And the reason in the law that outlawed it states this, because man is made in God's image. So here you have a secular law from this guy whose conversion we all doubt was genuine, yet Christian morality was affecting these laws. And in 321, labor was to cease on the first day of the week, except for farmers who absolutely had to harvest on Sunday, and so forth. Labor was made illegal, in a sense, on the Sunday. Now, it was the Christian Sabbath, but really it became sort of the secular Sabbath. And so there's two extremes to avoid here. This is just a mental exercise that really is maybe our first example of testing ourselves to see how much of this smoke and mirrors thesis we adopt. Let's avoid two extreme misunderstandings here. One of them is that Sunday is a pure biblical notion. In fact, the names of the days in all of the Romance languages are derived from the names of the gods which presided over each day. But the other extreme is that Sunday worship originated at this time from that pagan idea. We've already seen that it did not. I've shown you from the letters of Ignatius and Clement at the end of the first century and the two verses in the Bible that the Lord's Day was Sunday as early as the first century. So on the one hand, the names of these days and Constantine's motives were pagan. On the other hand, Sunday worship did not originate with Constantine. Okay, so let's avoid those two extremes because we've already shown that that's simply not true. Beyond that, laws were passed eliminating taxes on the barren and widows, and many debts were nullified. He introduced laws that curbed the practice of leaving newborn babies to die. He began a fund to care for those babies, and he outlawed the gladiator contests, at least in his dominion. Now, that happens still out east, but the point is that those laws went out there and it was being affected by Christian morality. So, as I said, Licinius still retained power in the east until Constantine sold enough of the population on the very attractive idea of a united Christian world civilization. And he was victorious in battle after battle. So about a decade later, between 323 and 325, he starts to move his forces this way, chasing the forces of Licinius all the way up very conveniently to about where he's going to put his capital eventually. And he finally conquers in the Battle of Bosphorus in September of 324. So now Constantine, by 324, is sole ruler of the empire. In spite of everything that we're going to see, it remains true that multitudes of Christians were now released at this time. Christians who were sentenced to life in the mines because Licinius had gone back on his word on that edict of toleration. They were now released and free to spread the gospel and live for their Lord. Again, mixed bag. Constantine, if you ask me, was he full of it? I'm going to say, to a certain extent, yes. But that doesn't change the fact that living conditions were better for Christians and that Christian morality did affect civil law at that time. If that's worth something, then that's a good thing, irrespective of the genuineness of Constantine's conversion. Now, Constantine was very troubled when he traveled through the East and found just as much division as he had out West. For the past 10 years... he had been hearing about this controversy raging, especially down here, but there had been councils that had been held up here. And that was over a controversy called the Donatist controversy. Let me just write that up here. Well, let me actually write it down here, because this is where the guy was. So Nicaea was actually not the first council that was held under this Christian empire, nor was it even the first presided over by Constantine. At Arles in 314, this Donatist controversy was dividing the church in the West. The idea originally came from Novatus, and I sort of briefly mentioned this in a previous lecture. He was the Roman bishop a century before, and the whole idea was that the controversy over what was called the lapsi, those that had lapsed in the faith. In other words, those under persecution who had renounced the name of Christ for fear of persecution. It's not even an L. What is that? You get the idea. My script is suffering today. But these were those that lapsed under. And so the Donatists said these can't be considered part of the church. And so the names Catholic and Donatist became in contrast. And one of the earliest meanings and connotations of Catholic was the universal church, you know, as opposed to these purist Nazis who are going around saying that if you're not as faithful as them, if you're not as hardcore as them under persecution, then you're not really a Christian. And universally, the Catholic faith and definition of the church conquered over the Donatist. The reason it was called Donatist was because the new bishop that was elected in Carthage at this time was a guy named Donatus. And the standing bishop argued that most of the majority had actually been lapsi, but this didn't stop the Donatist aspirations. Both sides made their appeal to the new Christian emperor, and 2 years later in 316, Constantine was able to give his attention to it and essentially rule on the council's previous findings at Arles 2 years before. So the Donatists were put down again. Universally, they were considered to be not only heretics, but dangerous ones and violent ones, because when these councils would happen, they wouldn't get their way, and their answer was to turn their monks into a bunch of goons to start creating violence. In fact, a lot of the violence that happens that you hear about in church, you know, those early Christian violence against each other, well, okay, that masks a truth that there was violence, but it was typically by these outsider sects that would turn their monks into goons when they were outsiders. And so they started to see themselves as sort of vigilante groups. But it's not true that the church was all physically killing each other in an unqualified sense. Any questions about anything so far before we get to Arius and the controversy, the end of Constantine's life, all that stuff? Okay. So, he sees, this is his first dealing with the church. And so, 10 years later, when he gets in sole control of the empire, he sees another controversy raging out east, and he's much more troubled by it, because the divisions out east were sharper, and they were over the very nature of Christ. And it was specifically sharp in Alexandria, where the head bishop, Alexander, disputed with one of his presbyters, Arius, over the question of Christ's divinity. That's a subject that we're going to return to in great detail in just a little bit. But Constantine's reaction to this, like everything else, is purely political. He is a pure politician. He favors Christianity, but he allowed the freedom of any religion. And that's not the problem. The problem is that that shapes his theology. When he envisioned a new capital, a new Rome, in modern-day Istanbul, it bore his name, and so too did the new Spirit of Genius statue in the city's form. You remember that phrase, the Spirit of Genius, that Augustus, back and right after Julius Caesar, so in 44, that's Julius, that's not the exact date I'm looking for, 20, it was in the third decade, B.C., Augustus, as early as him, is starting to, the statues everywhere are celebrating the Spirit of Genius. So Rome would allow you to worship whatever local deity you wanted, as long as you paid homage to the Spirit of Genius of the emperor. Well, Constantine retains that idea. Okay, so he hadn't thoroughly cleansed them of that idea. And it took a few years to build, and historians are in disagreement about the year it began, but certainly in between the years 325 and 327. But Constantine's growing distaste for the politics of the old Rome must have played some part. He had considered Rome, he had been ruling out there, but he realized, I don't want to build on what's already been built. And he actually considered Troas as well, but he didn't want any kind of foundation, whether it's Greek or Roman civilization. He wanted a clean start. So, you know, you say, well, he was thoroughly pagan. In some ways, that's true. And in some ways, he was very, very intentional about wanting to start something uniquely Christian. He might have been very confused about what that was, but he did show some political daring and vision here. But anyway, the city would be called Constantinople. And though it would propagate Christian ideals and protect Christian individuals, it would also exist on the premise of secular Catholicity. Let me write that, because that's going to be really what you start to see is Romanism as a worldview. So let me add this as a synonym, secular Catholicity. And as I already said about the Donatist controversy, Catholic, lowercase c, is not a dirty word. It shouldn't be. It just means oneness or universal. Now, in biblical theology, is there only one church? Yes, Ephesians 4:4 says so. If what you mean is the one body of Christ, regardless of what particular flavor of worship they have in the local assembly. But secular Catholicity starts to define that unity from the ground up, starts to define that unity from a physical structure or a physical head. Now, why was that a worldview? Because on this foundational point, this idea of the empire and the Spirit of Genius defined the world and defined civilization, defined humanity, defined anything worth having as something that was under this particular head coming from Rome, whether it came from Rome or whether it came from Constantinople. This idea was a universalistic worldview. It was an aspect of paganism which was never really rooted out of the minds of the leaders of Western civilization. And so on May 11th, 330, he christened the city. Christened, sort of, with the help of the church's clergy and with the trappings of pagan artistic expressions, including, by the way, the mother goddess of the East. Beginning in 324, many were offered such things as white robes and pieces of gold to be baptized and therefore to be considered Christians. Now, he would not use force, contrary to the myths. His sons would, but he would use bribery. He would use this idea, this vision of secular Catholicity, including some things such as gold, for people to, quote, convert. All right, so you see that right from the beginning, this kind of perversion, obviously, of those elements of the faith. Eusebius of Caesarea, the author of the church history, became a court advisor, a trusted friend of Constantine. So did the militant Arian, Eusebius of Nicomedia. And we know that Constantine was beginning to turn his sights eastward to regain the splendor of Jerusalem, since he dedicated a church there and was known in his final weeks to be hatching a strategy to subjugate the Persians to an early global Christendom. And so he had his sights. I mean, this guy, not only was he brilliant politically, but his aspirations were to go as far as Alexander did, except to subjugate the Persians to a Christian empire, and in a sense, if not make their, you know, their secular capital here, their spiritual capital again in Jerusalem. Those were his plans. Didn't work out because he died shortly thereafter. But the first critics of Constantine's conversion, interestingly, were pagans. In their minds, he called himself a Christian either to appease the new majority, to loot their old temples, or out of guilt for the murder of his wife and son. She was mysteriously found drowned, and it was widely accepted that he was behind this, since she was part of an earlier pact anyway. She was given to him, what was her name, Fausta, something like that? Anyway, she was given to him by, I think it was Galerius, who was reigning in this part of the empire, and that was common. That was common to have those kind of marriages from one, and that continues in monarchy throughout European history after that. And so they were all, this is one of the reasons why they killed each other, because they were given these brides often to begin with as sort of this Trojan horse into the royal house, so that somebody could capitalize if they didn't have a clear heir. Anyway, he or somebody close to him murders them, including the son that she bore to him, so that there was no chance that some other pagan from the old order could say that this person actually has the right to the throne later on. So, it's true that he was only baptized in his final year in 337, but it is also true that postponement of baptism until the end of life was becoming increasingly common for many Christians as superstitions arose about the sacraments. And we're going to have more to say about that later, where those superstitions arose. That's another problem, is that, you see, theologians thinking about such things in the 4th century started to use baptism as this, this, and that. Well, there's another possibility, and one is that superstitions that were already there for centuries in paganism, you know, like demons physically inhabiting the world, and the waters of baptism maybe being used as a chemistry experiment or some way to scrub away some element of evil or some dark force, that might have been a pagan idea that they were coming out of, and so that's why people sort of took it for granted. So you've got to think about those things that are more simple explanations. But at any rate, those ideas came not so much from Rome, but from radical purity sects like the Montanists and the Donatists, who were ready to deny confirmation of genuine faith to anybody who was not as pure as they perceived themselves to be. Now, beyond that, Constantine had expressed a desire as early as 323 to be baptized in the Jordan River when he was making plans to annex the eastern part of the empire. But he was otherwise occupied with war and then division in the church, and so this new Jerusalem never really materialized. In the final analysis, it's been difficult for the most conservative church historians to regard his faith as genuine spiritual rebirth, and they cite his murderous practices, his pagan concessions, his opposition to true doctrine whenever it suited his government, and for his belief about his own baptism. Perhaps, he thought, it would wash away all those sins so often and treacherously committed. One historian, I think one of the best, Philip Schaff, is worth summarizing for a fair treatment of Constantine's faith. Schaff says this, "But with the political, he united also a religious motive, not clear and deep, indeed, yet honest, and strongly infused with the superstitious disposition to judge of a religion by its outward success and to ascribe a magical virtue to signs and ceremonies." So, any questions at all about the life of Constantine, his faith and what he did, before we get to Nicaea? All right, I'll probably do 10 minutes of the road to Nicaea, and I'll look at the clock and stop it, and we'll have some conversation before our second session. So, the road to Nicaea. One historian, I think rightly, says this, "The mystery of Christ's divinity was the first and greatest problem for the educated Christian mind. The whole mystery of the church is contained in it. The church is not only Christ's work, but Christ's body, daily born anew and quickened anew by his Spirit. In her meetings, he himself, he who is unseen and sits at the right hand of God, is in the midst of her. As the nature of Christ, such is the nature and worth of his church. When the church reflects on Christ's being, she is brought face to face with the mystery of her own." That's a sort of a clue, a theological clue as to why this is going to matter. And that's really one of the main tensions. The main tension in the 4th century is not just Arianism versus Orthodox Christology. The main tension in the 4th century that's underneath that tension is, does this even matter or not? And that tension is the main tension today. People don't care today whether or not Arius was right. And for that reason, they don't really care that he won, and maybe would have preferred that he did win. In fact, they suspect that the more wrong your doctrine is, the more peaceable you'll be. But that was the real tension simmering under this tension. Other historians, for example, have criticized the church for being so short-sighted as to exchange civilization for a mere, and you know it's a British person writing it when he says, metaphysical row. A row. That's their word for fight, because they can't, so they call it a row. Anyway. or as Gibbons put it, famously in the 18th century, over one little iota. And the idea here is that if you guys weren't fighting about one little iota, and I'm going to show you literally it's an iota. If you weren't fighting over that, then when the Muslims came, you might have been able to beat them back or extend Christian civilization, by which people like Gibbons and people in the Enlightenment would have been okay to say modern liberal, you know, the moral teachings of Jesus, will kind of mix that in, stuff like that. If you weren't fighting over this doctrinal stuff, over stuff you can't show anyway, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, you might have been able to build an actual secular, liberal, good thing for everybody. But the majority of people in the church of the first few decades of the 4th century, they were freshly delivered from horrible persecution. They were convinced that on that one little iota hangs the whole thing. Just as critical writers will prefer, they'll refer to proto-orthodoxy. We've talked about that prior to the first four centuries, or sorry, prior to the 4th century, proto-orthodoxy. They'll talk about that in order to dismiss orthodoxy as such, so they will sometimes speak of logos Christology. Oh, I'll just use, in fact, make a mental picture of that. Got it? Go. Okay. Let me get that out of here, because it's going to be all theology now. A metaphysical row. I'm going to throw a row on the board here. For all the pinheads out there and divisive malcontents. Alright? Logos Christology. You know, one of many brands of Christology, and as we're going to see, obviously the one that shouldn't have won, and probably won by the use of goons and backroom deals. Logos Christology. And this is coined in order to dismiss the earliest belief in the deity of Christ. By logos, or word Christology, they simply mean the commitment to the truth that the person of Christ is divine, the second member of the Trinity, and therefore that the doctrine of the Son of God begins in the divine nature and flows down toward the human nature that he takes on, not the other way around, not side by side. When you're thinking about the doctrine of Christ, Jesus is both fully God and fully man. However, he is a divine person with a divine and human nature. He is not two persons. He is not one nature. He is not an amalgamation of two natures. He's a divine person prior to, logically antecedent to, his human nature. Now, theology in all stripes today absolutely rejects that and bucks against that, that top-down thinking. But that's just monotheism. God comes first before the things he's made. That's just monotheism. He's God first. He freely and contingently takes on human flesh. To have an opposite view of Christ is to have a non-monotheistic doctrine of Christ. And it's about time the theologians in church histories say that and regard this kind of commentary in church histories to be the unchristian, anti-theistic nonsense that it is. But for the Greeks, prior to this time, matter and physical motion were eternal givens. So that it took someone thinking on the same level as a Plato or an Aristotle to conceive of ultimate categories as transcending the world where things are only ever distinct particulars. To speak of two persons in a procession, such as the Father and the Son, and by the way, when you don't hear as much talk about the Holy Spirit in the early decades of the 4th century, it's not because they had any problem assigning to him the same deity as the Father and the Son. It's simply because the issue, a controversy, it would become the Spirit once you get to the 380s. But for now, they had bigger fish to fry, and that was Arius' denial of the deity of the Son. And so the concentration is over there. But to speak of two persons in a procession just was to speak of two things and not one. That's the categories they're trying to get in their mind. We've got a lot of labels today for the divisions which arise from this thinking. But the clearest way to classify things is to recognize, and here's a big word, monarchianism. But I'll just show you what I mean here. All of the ideas that came out of Logos Christology in the first couple centuries were concerned to maintain the idea that there was one head, monarche, one head to the divine nature, that he was not more than one thing. The first cause, it would be irrational to assume that the first cause was more than one thing, that he was divided, that he was not a simple unity. Okay? So the monarchian mindset began to dominate after the thinking of Origen in the 3rd century. The focus on a singular head had the Father sending forth the Son as the incarnation of either himself, as a mode of his person, or else putting a little bit of himself in the human person who was distinct yet subordinate. And so a lot of people, they're afraid that you're either going to be a tritheist, that you're actually speaking of three things, three divine things, or else a what became a modalist, someone who thinks that the persons are just expressions of the one person, who's really ultimately just one being one person. Okay, so you want to avoid both of those extremes, and so people would get on one extreme versus the other of that debate. So, real quickly, 2 more minutes summation of where this thought emerged in the first couple centuries. Of those who had the defense of the monarchy on the mind, there were 2 basic strands of emphasis. So in monarchianist thought, there's basically, I say 2, but there's really 3 different directions you can go. Let me list these out. There's in your notes, but for those of you who don't have the notes, let me just lay it out. First, the biblical revelation can be thought of this way. Moving from the communication of Yahweh, from the Father God in the Old Testament, to the incarnation of the Son in the New Testament, to finally the outpouring of the Spirit by the time you get to the book of Acts, so that the 3 divine persons are really what we might call modes of his existence. Hence the later name given to this doctrine was modalism. So that's the first place you can go while you're trying to protect things within this thinking. Modalism. By contrast, the focus on the independence of the divine person leads inevitably to the notion of subordination, which in and of itself was not considered heresy. Justin Martyr, and then eventually the Alexandrian school that Origen was a part of, had previously laid heavy stress on the uniqueness and distinctness of the Logos from the Father. Now, there's 2 different ways that you can talk, that you can really focus on distinctness. One is subordinationism. There is subordination in the Trinity, but subordinationism sees everything through that, and the 3rd one we're going to talk about will be adoptionism. So those are the 3 basic options you have if your obsession is, I've got to protect the monarchy of the divine nature, the oneness of it, the one head. And so this is just one other way you can go, this idea of the distinctness of the Logos from the Father. And the understanding stretches back to the pre-Socratics, way before the time of Plato and Aristotle. The link between the Word, now this is one of the elements of Greek thought that's just human thought, it's just a part of general revelation. A lot of people that aim their guns at Nicaea and the early centuries of Christian theology, they're aiming against this. They're aiming against this basic monotheistic thinking. Greek philosophy, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not, was moving in a monotheistic direction with Plato and Aristotle. Now that got upended, but one of their cardinal ideas was this idea of the Logos being the rational ordering principle to everything out here. So when they started to talk about spirit, the Greeks were naturalists, just like modernists are. They believed that matter and energy were the ultimate things, but they still had on the brain, I've got to explain the unity of the diversity of these things down here, and I still have to explain what animates this, what makes sense of it. And so the ultimate essence of everything was spiritual. Logikos, Paul uses that phrase, and it can either mean spiritual or rational. The word meant, the 2 words meant the same thing. But since modern Christians are really Gnostic and not Christian, we don't believe that spiritual and rational are the 2 same things. They are. And so that Greek word meant that all the way back to the pre-Socratics, and the early Christians used that in the same way. Why? Because Paul did. And if Paul did, then that means the Holy Spirit did. So the Holy Spirit, at least, is under the impression that intellect is one of the defining characteristics of God Himself. Christ is called the Logos by John in his Gospel. And the reason everything is rationally ordered down here is because God Himself is rational. And that's, by the way, why you have science emerge in the Western world and you don't have it in other places. Because you have this expectation that everything is rational and intelligent and so on and so forth. Anyway, I'll get back to the development of this thought when we come back from the break. But this is what the apologists like Justin Martyr and Hippolytus and eventually Origen and Clement in the Alexandrian school were really focusing on. But they were very complex in their thinking. In their minds, there was no contradiction between the divine essence being the same in the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, and there being distinction between the Logos and the Father. They were thoroughgoing Trinitarians, and you have a bunch of mindless critics today that look at they take their words out of context, and you say, well, Origen really, really focused on the distinction between the Logos and the Father. He wasn't really a Trinitarian. And stuff like that. And so, a lot of simple-minded people existed in the 3rd century as well, 3rd and 4th century, and so they started to pit one of these ideas against another, and they'd come up with one of these anti-Trinitarian heresies. So let's go to break, open it up to questions, and then we'll talk about how this gets them to the Nicene controversy.